تهب يريح الحياة دايما بما لا أشتهي واللي السنين ما قدمه غير اللي قلت نفسي فيه يلاقي قلبي فين دواء واللي أزاه أقرب مديه ده جرح بيعلم وصعب تسكن الألام واخرج من اللي فات سليم وصعب لما روح أنام مفضلش راجع القديم طلع مكلف.
This is True Talk.
Welcome to True Talk on WMNF 80.5 and also the True Talk podcast that's available on your podcast platforms. On today's show, we're continuing our coverage of what's happening in Gaza, and we have two special guests that will be speaking to you today. One who had just returned from Gaza on a medical mission where she was helping provide care for people who need medical care in Gaza. We're going to speak to her about her firsthand experience and what she witnessed there directly. And also on the show today, we'll have somebody who has been politically active locally, trying to put pressure on local officials to call for a ceasefire. And as far as the numbers are concerned, the numbers as far as the number of people killed in Gaza is now tops 30,000 people. Some say it's as high as 40,000 if you count those that are missing that are under the rubble. All indications lead that that's an undercount in the number of death, and some over 70,000, say 80,000 injured. Majority of those, two-thirds, some say as much as 70%, are women and children. Some 12,000 to 15,000 children have been killed. For the first time this last Sunday, Vice President Kamala Harris had called for a ceasefire. But if you actually listen to the speech, she calls for a ceasefire, and then she says, for at least 6 weeks. So that's not really much different than what the U.S. government has been calling for. And if you kind of look at the fine print of the speech and the rhetoric or the messaging coming out of the White House, they're really putting it on Hamas. If Hamas releases the hostages, then there would be a ceasefire. So it's kind of a conditional ceasefire. It received a lot of applause as if that's somehow a shift in policy. But after a closer look, it seems like it's not much different. So I'm actually now going to be joined with our guests, Rana Mahmoud, is it? Yes. Yes, of course. Sorry. So many names that were coming across. But Rana Mahmoud is originally from Palestine. She migrated to the United States at the age of 11. She's been a nurse for over 20 years, serving around the Tampa Bay area where this show broadcasts from. And she recently went on a medical mission with an organization called PAMA, Palestine American Medical Association, where she provided urgent medical care for those in Gaza. And it's, you know, we hear a lot about that, but also joining us, and we're going to get into that in a minute, but also joining us is Megan Ammer. Megan Ammer is a professor, former professor of international affairs. You know, once a professor, always a professor, I guess. I will call her Professor Megan, and also former State Department official. We're going to talk about the politics and the diplomacy about all of this in a bit. But first, I want to speak to Rana. Rana, you're a nurse. You're serving the Tampa Bay area. Why did you make a decision to go to Palestine?
Humanity calls.
What do you mean?
Humanity calls. I watched a lot of social media videos, and there was a lot of inhumanity that I saw, and I saw my own people getting killed, and I was well aware that there was a lack of healthcare and healthcare providers and lack of, you know, medical supplies as well too. So I was given the opportunity and an honor to travel with PAMA, and I right away took that opportunity.
So you actually went there while the war on Gaza afterwards?
We went there January 22nd. We entered
this year.
Yes. We went January 22nd of 2024, and we exit February 5th. Of 2024. We were there for 14 days. It was a group of five of us. but there were other, of course, you know, medical providers from other medical missions. But PAMA, it was five of us.
So you, that's a risky mission. You're going to one of the most dangerous parts in the world with constant bombardments. We've seen so many medical officials, medical staff get killed, journalists, ambulance workers, hospitals. I don't think there's a single hospital in Gaza that hasn't been bombed or destroyed or impacted. Knowing all that, you risked your life to go there. Why?
Like I said, humanity calls. It was.
I have humanity calls for everyone, but I don't know people just rushing into a war zone like that at their own risk, knowing what this regime was capable of and what they've been doing there, and you still went.
I'm going to be honest with you. It felt pretty safe there. I felt fearless, and it felt pretty safe being there. I mean, given the amount of
Can you clarify that? Because when you say it felt safe there, as if there's no violence, there was violence, right?
There was violent, and we heard bombing constantly. We heard bombing, and of course, you know, we saw a lot of people being killed. I attended barriers myself, and I saw so many people in the emergency room being rushed and killed and on the floor. I've seen so many, but for me as a person, and I know that I was there to provide medical care. I felt fearless. I felt safe being there.
Where did that safety come from?
Everything. I overlooked everything. And I was only focused on providing medical care.
So you mean you just ignored all the bombings and things and violence that's happening around you? Because people listening to this may misunderstand you know, what their idea of safety is, that, you know, you were just at Advent Health Hospital or something, or Baycare. And
it was nothing like that. You heard constant bombing all the time, and you saw, and I witnessed so many people being killed all the time. And I witnessed starvation as well, too. And I witnessed lack of medical supplies, lack of medical resources. It's unsafe to be there. Yes, I agree to that. However, I felt the need to be there, which is why I went on this medical mission.
It sounds like you weren't as concerned about your own safety, and you were focused on providing the necessary urgent care to people that needed it the most. Which hospital or hospitals did you serve in, or where did you serve?
We served at the European Hospital because it's the only hospital that is functioning right now in Gaza.
And which part of Gaza is that in?
I would say that's Khan Yunis.
Khan Yunis, okay. But we've seen images where Khan Yunis itself came under bombardment, and people that evacuated in the north and went to Khan Yunis for safety because they were told that's where the safe zones were. And yet it was not safe there. Hospitals and communities and neighborhoods were bombed, and people were then, and it was Khan Yunis was eventually invaded, and people were pushed further south into Rafah. Did you see any of that happening?
Oh, yeah. Constantly. We actually, like I said, we heard constant bombing all the time we were there, and we saw a lot of people being displaced. Actually, the European hospital only can hold up to 200 beds, and there was about 12,000 people in the hospital.
12,000 people? Were they all patients, or they were also just using it as a place of shelter?
I would say a fraction of that 12,000 is patients, and then the remainder would be using it as shelter because they were previous patients, and then when they're discharged, they have nowhere to go, so they're using it as shelter.
If you're listening to our show live, I'm speaking to Rana Mahmoud. She's a nurse serving in the Tampa Bay area. She recently returned from Palestine in Gaza, where she was on a mission, medical mission, to provide urgent medical care there, with a mission with a delegation part of the Palestine American Muslim Association. She's talking about her experience there when she served. You serve in hospitals here in the United States. How was your experience to be serving in such a war zone in what many people, including myself, call a genocide? What was that like? What were the conditions in the hospital? Did you have the necessary equipment or tools to do your job?
I did not have the necessary tools to do our job. Unfortunately, the hospital, first of all, let's talk about the healthcare workers. They've been working for over 5 months, not being paid, exhausted. They haven't had any days off. So there's a lack of healthcare workers. And of course, there's a lot of healthcare workers that lost their lives as well too. Then we're going to talk about the lack of resources. They don't have many resources right now. There is a lot of high demand for medical supplies and medications. So it was a disaster. It's a true disaster. I've never been in a war zone. This was my first time in a war zone, and it was a complete catastrophe. It was a complete disaster, to be honest.
What didn't you... Okay, so let's talk about just some of the basic things you need to have in a hospital. You know, this, you're not just treating, you know,
water,
flu and COVID. What did you not have? You didn't even have water. So how are you supposed to run a hospital without water?
We have limited water. We had no soap, no hand soap. We had limited hand sanitizers, if it wasn't for the hand sanitizers that I took with me. We had limited gloves to work with. We had limited gauze to work with. We had limited medications to work with. Every medical supply, just the basic need of medical supplies, they were all very limited. Luckily, we did take a lot of medical supplies with us. But at that hospital, there are limited medical supplies and limited medications. Diabetes medication. There was no diabetic medication. There was no high blood pressure medication. There's no heart disease medication. There's no medication to reduce temperatures. There's not a lot of antibiotics to treat infections. And we had a lot of wounds to treat, and we needed a lot of antibiotics. And there was none of that.
How were you treating the wounds?
There was a group of doctors came together and myself, and we created a wound care team. And with the supplies that we brought on board and the medications that we brought on board, we were able to do a lot of wound care while we were there. Wound care, there was a lot of infection going around. The wound care itself was all disastrous, to be honest. And they didn't even have enough staff to take care of the wound care, the wounds that they have, because it was a severe amount of wounds. And they didn't have the staff or the medical supplies to do that, but we were able to help out.
As far as we've heard stories of so many injuries, amputations, shrapnel, you know, wounds, or I guess severe surgeries that need to be done because of shrapnel and bombs and things, and people were doing amputations without anesthesia. Did you witness those things?
We had limited narcotics and opiates to work with, but I personally did not witness any of that at the European hospital. We did have limited supplies to work with and medications, but I mean, it was limited, and there was a lot of surgeries performed, and I witnessed so many of them, but luckily we had enough supplies and enough narcotics to cover that. But it's the post-op care that we did not have the medication to cover further pain relief.
Where did you sleep when you were there?
At the hospital.
Well, so you're sleeping at the hospital. You're basically living at the hospital. And how long were your days?
I was there for 14 days. There was limited bathroom time. Limited bathrooms. And as far as hygiene, it's very difficult to get in a shower or to brush your teeth or even to perform the basic hygiene.
So it makes us appreciate the things that we have here.
Absolutely.
And, you know, we take it for granted. We're going to show some of these images in a little bit, because I've seen some of the images. Some of the images I can't even show to our viewers, that we can describe some of them, you know. Did you ever at some point, mentally, did you break down after seeing all this trauma?
Every day. Every single day from the time I arrived to maybe 2 weeks after I came back to the U.S., honestly, it has been very difficult even to perform my basic needs every day.
I can imagine. I want to bring Megan into the conversation. As for some reason, some motorcycle just came by. But Megan, I want to bring you into the conversation. Megan Ammer, she's again a professor of international affairs. And she's also a former State Department staff individual. I want to bring you into this conversation. I'm sure you've seen some of these images and that you've known Rana, who just returned back, Rana Mahmoud, who just returned back or recently from Palestine and Gaza. And understanding, I think you're also a mother. When you see the images there and some of the images that Rana had shared with us, many of them of children, what comes to mind?
My God, it's absolutely heartbreaking. I think what Rana has done and what she's going to continue to do and to go back again is absolutely heroic. I mean, she's completely put her life on the line. This is the second time that kind of really hurt her experiences, and I'm in tears here just listening to her talk. And to think if I had to watch my child go through something like that, it just, I want to break out and cry right now.
Yes, it is. It's so traumatizing. I'm going to ask to just show some image. And Megan, if you could just stand by, we're going to bring you back on in a bit to discuss that, especially the politics. Rana, you sent me some images. I want to just share them now. And then, you know, maybe you can describe what we're looking at. But keep in mind, some of the listeners that are just listening on radio, so you kind of have to describe what we're seeing here. As far as some of these images, let me see. Okay. Yeah, for some reason that part is not operating right now, but I'm going to have that in a bit. But can you describe to me, Rana, how did you get into Gaza?
We got into Gaza through Egypt.
So, okay, how did you get? You took a flight from Tampa, you got on a flight, you flew to Egypt, and then you just told them, I'm going to Gaza, and they said, okay.
No, of course not. It was organized by PAMA. It was organized by our leader in PAMA. It was organized through the United Nations and the World Health Organization. It took about 6 weeks of organizing this trip, to be honest. And like I said, there was other medical mission trips from other countries, and you submit that permission to enter, and then the United Nations and the World Health Organization organize a convoy, and there's certain dates, certain times that we have to be on that road, all the way from Egypt until we get to the border of Rafah. And it was about a 13-hour drive that day. And we had about 8 checkpoints throughout the route.
8 checkpoints. So it's 13-hour drive in the car. And yeah. Was this car a convoy protected?
Well, I mean, we were told that it's protected and there's something called deconflict the route. And like I said, United Nations and the World Health Organization they organize that for us. They organize that for medical mission trips. And that's all I'm aware of.
I mean, we've heard situations where the United Nations have said that, you know, they inform the Israelis of the cars or the convoys or the ambulances,
correct,
where they are exactly. And they're not supposed to be bombing near there. But so many times those people actually ended up getting bombed and getting killed. The United Nations has lost, 120 people.
120 people. Honestly,
they knew where those people are, you know, and some of the United Nations schools were even bombed, you know, UNRWA and so many places. So just
and over 100 ambulances have been bombed as well.
100 ambulances.
Correct.
That could have been your convoy. That could have been you. But you were willing to take that risk. It's excellent. I mean, not excellent, but I'm still in disbelief.
Doing it again.
Things. You would do it again?
I am doing it again. March 23rd, I leave again for another trip.
What? Okay,
yes.
You're disclosing this here that you're going again. I want to bring Megan back into the conversation. Megan, Rana is going back to Gaza in March. March when?
23rd.
That's in Ramadan.
That's correct.
And there's no ceasefire yet. So I don't know. What is your reaction to this, Megan?
It's unbelievable. But I think I feel Rania, she's a mother as well. And when you have a calling, you feel the need, you have to be there. You have to do something. And it's amazing that she's able to use her skills and try to do some good and actually bring some medical supplies across the border, because it seems like that's the only way that medical supply seems to be getting across the border now, is in through suitcases of a couple of medical professionals that are going for 2 weeks, which is unbelievable to me.
Seems like a drop in the bucket compared to the need that exists, when it's just, you know, the individual volunteers, the delegation of 5 people that are taking their supplies with them, when you have 70,000 injured people, when you have so many orphans, you don't have the medicine, like you said. I mean, how many people are going to die because they don't have their diabetes or cholesterol or high blood pressure medicine? It's even, you know, I mean, I've read reports that even if the bombing stopped today, you know, tens of thousands more will just die because of the starvation, because of the disease, et cetera. You've been trying to collect signatures. You know, I've seen images where you've been tabling at local protests around Tampa Bay. What are you collecting signatures for, Megan?
Well, since this started, I kind of noticed there has been a lack of support of our elected officials, especially for the Muslim community, especially for the Palestinian community here in Tampa. There's a very large Palestinian diaspora here in Tampa. And for some reason, our representatives seem to have forgotten that. And I think a lot of people like Rania and my neighbor here in Union Park, in a beautiful little neighborhood, has family over there that are dying and that are affected, and they're grieving. So I wrote this letter to our 2 senators, Marco Rubio and Rick Scott, and 3 representatives that kind of cover the Tampa Bay region, just saying, hey, we understand that's great that, you know, after October 7th, you gave your condolences to Israel, but you never did that for the Palestinian community. You've never recognized that a genocide's going on or that people are dying. And so I want them to hear from the Muslim community and know that we have a voice, that we are a big community here in Tampa, and that we will organize, and that 3 of the representatives are up for re-election this year. And we will come out to the polls in August, because there has been no communication from them with the Muslim community and no, I guess, recognition of the grief that the people here in Tampa Bay, and not just the Palestinian community, not just the Muslim community, but multiple people here in the Tampa Bay community are feeling in regards to what's going on in Gaza.
As a former State Department official, are you surprised at the lack of or the refusal of the current State Department to make any policy changes when it comes to Gaza or when it comes to Palestine?
I guess yes and no. Obviously, the State Department is a big bureaucracy. There are a lot of people in the State Department that oppose this and do want the policy to change. But sometimes policy is centered at the White House. You know, I mean, the State Department works at the behest of the executive branch. The State Department works for the president. That's what they do. So it is the executive, the president, that makes the final decision on foreign policy matters, no matter what the recommendations are. There has been State Department dissent cables. It's a formal process at the State Department where you can send in a cable and it could be signed by multiple officials of the State Department dissenting with current policy. There's been one leaked to the news, and I'm sure there's been multiple ones. And I believe there's even kind of meetings going on from people that are dissenting with current policy. But unfortunately, again, the president has the final say.
President has described himself as a Zionist, and, you know, he said if there wasn't an Israel, we'd have to invent an Israel. People are surprised by how far he's willing to go. Tens of thousands have been killed, and he's continuing to provide the support. And over, regardless, I mean, you know, just over the weekend, they said they're going to airdrop some aid. But people are saying, you know, just a drop in the bucket compared to the, you know, the bombs. And what they really want is not the aid, the food aid. They just want the bombing to stop. How is it that this administration, in your mind, or how is it that people in the State Department or this government can justify at the same time, because even this national security spokesperson, John Kirby, said, oh, we can do both things, provide the food and provide the bombs. So Israel can, quote unquote, defend itself because they need these weapons to defend themselves. It doesn't look like Israel is defending themselves right now, or they are, who are they defending themselves from? Children and women and people that are starving? It doesn't make sense. How can you help us make sense of it, especially as Americans, that this administration just doesn't get the obvious? The whole world is saying, stop this, but the United States continues to provide this kind of cover and protection for Israel to give them the green light to do what they're doing.
Well, I wish I could say that this was unique in history, but unfortunately it's not. I mean, you've had multiple genocides where the UN didn't act, governments didn't act in Rwanda, Darfur, multiple ones. So unfortunately, this isn't new. And this is going to go down in the history books as all those other genocides and say, we wish we would have done something different. And sadly, but it's sad that our taxpayer dollars are paying for the war to actually occur. And then we're also paying for kind of the humanitarian aid to support it. And then we're probably also going to have to, our U.S. tax dollars will also pay for reconstruction as well. So we're being triple billed here on this war.
It doesn't make sense whatsoever. Some people just say the system is broken, that certain special interest group have extra influence on this administration, on our government in general, whether it's the Republicans and the Democrats when it comes to the Middle East. And do you think actions like the letter you're collecting signatures for, or petitions that others or lobbying our members of Congress, do those things make a difference? Do they matter?
They 100% matter, because look at what the current lobby, the other lobby has achieved, right? But that's been years in the making. It doesn't make a difference overnight. You can't make change overnight, but communities need to look at the long run. You know, the Muslim population is growing here in the U.S. If they start their own lobbying campaign, if they get their youth involved in politics 20 years from now, it's going to be a different story as well. You have to look at the long game. You can't give up. And I think it does put pressure on them, especially for local officials that cover regions that have populations that are totally against this war and that are becoming voters on one issue. We've only really seen that with the abortion issue before. But now a lot of people are coming on board saying, this is the one issue that I am going to vote for. And it's not just Muslims. It's multiple Americans right now that are going to say that they're going to vote for the officials solely on this issue.
Who are some of the people that are showing up to these protests around Tampa Bay?
Surprisingly, it is so multicultural. Like, I did one of my own little small protests in Wesley Chapel, and we had an African-American, we had a Puerto Rican, we had a Moroccan, we had a Palestinian, we had an Irish-American myself. It is so multicultural, and it's all different age groups. A lot of people are saying it's just the ultra, ultra left. It's not that. Even have a lot of veterans that came out in the protest last weekend in downtown Tampa as well. So it has been a huge mix. It's not just Muslims. It's not just Palestinians. This is a wide breadth of people saying, stop. Stop the genocide here.
I want to bring Rana back into the conversation. Rana, are you hopeful that the actions that Megan is recommending, would you think that that's going to make change? Obviously, it's not going to make change immediately for what's happening right now. Maybe it will eventually, if the politicians realize that it may cost them the election, that they'll change course. And it seems like more and more politicians are speaking out. It just Joe Biden has not, and some are even suggesting it may cost him the election. I don't want to put you on the spot, but there's an election this year. Do you plan to get involved in the election, or
what? I'll vote for Megan.
Oh, you'll vote for Megan. Okay. Vote for Megan. Well, I wish Megan was on the ballot, you know, but this is the thing. It's like,
Megan is not on the ballot, then I'll vote for myself.
Yeah. When you look at you know, the choices that we have between Trump, who banned, he tried to do the Muslim ban, and then Biden, who's allowing the wholesale genocide of Muslims and Palestinians, Arabs, Christians, because it's not just Muslims getting killed there. Are you hopeful? I mean, this is the country you migrated to. You came here as 11 years old. And this is a country that I, you know, I'm also Arab American, originally from Egypt. And this is kind of the difficulty that I have. This is my country. This is where I pay taxes. But they're responsible for the death of so many of my brothers and sisters overseas unjustly. I mean, the people in Gaza don't deserve this. The people in Palestine don't deserve this. But it just, you know, the hypocrisy that exists there. Yeah, I don't know what my question is, but I guess I'm venting to you. I'm proud of you that you're going back to provide this aid, but we shouldn't even have to do this. Do you ever feel like you shouldn't have to go there? The people in Gaza deserve the same type of medical care that we have here, especially these children, women that are pregnant. Did you deal with some of these pregnant women that we hear about that have to deliver in the streets or anywhere, or they, you know?
So I did witness a couple of incidents where, you know, about pregnant women. I did actually care for a pregnant woman who's been waiting to have a baby for 14 years. And she's had multiple surgeries, IVFs, to have this baby. And now she's being malnourished and she was injured and she was still 7 months pregnant. She was extremely actually malnourished. She's had no food. There's no IV fluids to give her. There's no nutrition to give her, even like through her IV or anything like that. So I was able to supply her with some of the food that I brought and some of the electrolytes that I brought for myself. I was able to provide her with some of that to kind of help, you know, aid with her nutrition. I also witnessed a couple of moms that delivered by midwives there, and they also had some complications and some malnutrition as well too. I mean, the situation, you know, as I explained before, it's a catastrophe. It's inhumane. There's no basic life needs. There's no basic anything. There's no bathrooms for some people. There's no water. There's no electricity. There's no internet. I mean, can you imagine one of our teenagers doesn't have internet these days? I mean, can you imagine some babies don't have blankets? They don't have any formula, no Pampers, nothing. There's nothing. There's no basic life needs.
And there's no food. There is now there's a famine that's happening, especially in North Gaza, where the starvation. I saw the images over the weekend, of course, this horrific, what they're calling the flour massacre that happened a few days ago, where people were rushing to the aid truck, especially in North Gaza. The aid trucks finally made it there, only to be fired upon by Israeli tanks, killing over 110 people. I don't remember the exact number, and dozens more that are injured. And then they start, you know, pointing the finger and saying, no, you know, they killed themselves. They got run over. It was a stampede. When all the evidence suggests and points, especially at the hospitals, that people arrived there with bullets, you know, it was from, you know, bullet wounds is the reason why they were killed. And those bullets were only coming from one direction. So even when the aid is getting there, they're shooting these individuals and it's being broadcast live. Are you, when you're there and providing this kind of medical care, how do you stay not angry and focused to focus on your patients when it's so obvious? I mean, we're here thousands of miles away and we're so angry at what we're seeing because we see who's behind all this pain and suffering and no one seems to be able to stop them or willing to stand up to get involved. How are you dealing with it while you're on the ground there?
I never said I wasn't angry. I never said I wasn't hurt or emotionally drained. That's absolutely not how I felt. I was extremely angry. I was extremely frustrated. I extremely felt for the people. But I needed to stay focused so I could help them. And I cried every time I cared for every patient. And every patient I cared for had a sad story. They either lost their home, lost their family, or lost a limb. There's not one person that I encountered did not have a great loss. There's not one person I encountered.
And how were you providing comfort to them?
Everything, moral support as much as we could. I mean, you know, like I said, it's mentally and emotionally draining, but I needed to stay strong so I could do the best that, you know, I could do for them.
What are you suggesting, Megan, for people that see this kind of, the atrocities are happening, the evil that's being pushed forward? This is on the scale of World War II type violence where, you know, after that, the world said never again are we going to allow these things to happen. They're going to put things in place like the Geneva Convention and put, you know, wars, international law. But it seems like to not matter here only applies what people call the global South. They use those mechanisms, these institutions to control the poor countries, but somehow Western countries, powerful countries, the law does not apply to them. What do you say as a person who worked in international affairs and diplomacy at the State Department and taught it? What are people to do?
I know it's hard to hear it, but I think Rania even said it best when we were at another talk where you can't give up hope. There are failures within the system. It's kind of crazy because I believe at the State Department, there's even a special envoy for genocide, and they have a system set up at the State Department where if they think a genocide is occurring, that they have certain meetings that happen. But that system obviously has failed when it's in the best interest of the United States. And I think there are a lot of other interests of the United States in the Middle East. They want a democracy over there, right? So the issue is kind of much larger and much bigger. And I think that's why they've been able to kind of get away with what they have gotten away with. So we will probably see in a few years from now, a huge evaluation of the system. They'll probably try to put more checks and balances in there. But I have to say to the people, you can still produce change. Again, two representatives here in the Tampa Bay area that heavily support Israel up for re-election in August. If you're not registered to vote yet, you need to get registered to vote. And you need to get to the polls here in August because we can make a difference. Both of those representatives heavily support Israel. They both voted for the $19 billion supplemental. Didn't fully go through, but the $19 billion supplemental in the House is a $19 billion of aid, you know, military aid, et cetera, to Israel. And both of our representatives in the Tampa Bay area voted for that. Even the progressive representative, Kathy Castor. So you need to vote. You can make a difference in the long term if you stay active. And secondly, I also want to say, get involved in local politics because this issue has been infused down into local politics. If you haven't heard, Hillsborough County has currently changing their local ordinances so that they can invest in Israeli bonds. And this is at the local level. This is if you live in Hillsborough County, your county taxes are going to be invested in Israeli bonds. Of course, they said this is just to give them more options. So they're not actually going to do the investment yet. But think about it. They're paying county lawyers who probably make over $100 an hour to currently change the legislation right now. So they're making changes at the county level. So you also need to vote for your county executives as well. Additionally, in Hillsborough County, they give $100,000 a year to the Israeli Business Accelerator. Why is there an Israeli Business Accelerator here in Tampa? And why is our county tax dollars funding Israeli technology companies to kind of increase their sales here in the United States? The Israeli Business Accelerator even hosted an event up at the Florida Legislature where Israeli companies could, I guess, pretty much pitch to Florida state government agencies to buy their services. So to me, that seems like corruption. We're not pushing Irish companies. We're not pushing, you know, French companies. Why are we paying county taxpayer dollars to push for Israeli companies to get state government contracts with Florida government? So you need to get involved at the local level as well. You need to go to these meetings. You need to speak out. And we need to vote these county commissioners out as well. Only one county commissioner voted against changing local ordinances so that they can invest in Israeli bonds.
So obviously when you do that, when you start asking these kind of questions, there's going to be pushback by some people. Sometimes there are lobbyists, there are special interest groups, and there'll be accusations. I mean, I have my radio show on the station for many years, and even when I bring up this topic, when I talk about the rights of Palestinians, there are people from certain communities that want to attack my show, our show, as some sort of, my co-host who happens to not be here today, they attack us as somehow anti-Semitic because we're bringing up these questions of questioning the relationship with Israel and how that's actually not always consistent with our values. And what we're trying to tell the public and our listeners, and especially listeners that support us, know that these are, you know, that people are just simply trying to gaslight us or gaslight others, that questioning the relationship with Israel is an American thing to do, and it has nothing to do with anti-Semitism or Judaism. We're not criticizing them because they're Jewish. We have no problems with the Jewish community or Judaism. In fact, many of our allies that are working on this are actually people from the Jewish community who oppose the right-wing Netanyahu government and what they're doing in Gaza. So it's an uphill battle, but there's going to be, when people stick their necks out, there's going to be attacks and there's going to be attempts to, you know, do character assassinations and others. Are you concerned by your activism that somehow people will target you?
I am 100% concerned. I guess I would say I don't care. I think I have a very good, strong reputation, and any of the work that I've ever done, I've known for doing good work. I would say the same thing. You know, being against genocide is not being anti-Semitic. If I was a county commissioner and I was trying to, you know, get contracts only to Irish businesses, well, then you should fire me as well. This is just giving special treatment. It could be special treatment to French businesses. I don't care what it is. Why are we investing in foreign governments at the local level? We shouldn't be doing that in any government. So again, this is not calling out us, you know, a special one type of religion over another. It's just asking for equal treatment. That's all. And asking, I guess you could say, I'm put America first too, right? Like, why aren't we supporting local
businesses? That's Trump's slogan, America first. I don't know if that's consistent with the liberal Democrats.
But hey, in this case, it is.
Yeah. That's what's interesting, though, when you bring this up and people repeat the slogan, America first, but then they make an exception when it comes to Palestine. Or an exception when it comes to Israel, or progressives on the left, and they call them PEP, a progressive except on Palestine. I mean, you're progressive on all your values, except when it comes to Palestine, somehow you advocate for the bombing of Palestinians or you look the other way. You have to be consistent with our values. If you want human rights and healthcare and no police brutality here, that should be consistent with your values for people abroad as well. Otherwise, there's hypocrisy there, you know, that, and there can't be that. I want to bring Rana back in the conversation, and just, I was able to pull up one of the images that you have here, Rana.
So cute. This is myself and Dr. Raouf. Dr. Raouf was actually from another health organization. He came in with another medical mission trip, and him and I teamed up together to create a wound care team with also the help of one of our doctors as well. So anytime the children at the hospital sees medical professions, especially that are like, they think of us as foreigners, they like to run to us. They'll come and ask us for candy or just simply, you know, give them high five and take a picture with them. And it just brought them joy. Every time we took a photo with these children, it truly brought them joy. So we took as many photos as possible.
And which hospital was this again?
This is European Hospital. It's actually the only functioning hospital, like I said, that I'm aware of in Gaza right now.
Okay. Now, were these children actually patients or...
No, they all just lived in the hospital because they have nowhere else to go.
You're working in the hospital, but at the same time, you have these people that are just living there, and you're actually living in the hospital as well. So they're basically like your neighbors.
Yeah.
They
cleaned, they live there.
Why are people staying in the hospital?
They have nowhere else to go. They have lost their homes. They've been displaced.
one of the things I've also heard is that people were staying there because they think that they will not be bombed in a hospital. Would you say that that's true?
Honestly, that for most and everyone that I have run into, they were there because they have no homes. They had nowhere else to go.
They left their homes, or their homes were destroyed.
Their homes were destroyed. 90% of the people that I spoke with, their homes have been destroyed. Their belongings have been destroyed. They don't even have any personal identification. They're just in the hospital right now.
Are you in touch with people still in the hospital there?
Yes, many people.
And what are they describing that's happening now?
They most likely they're first of all, they're hoping for a ceasefire every day. They still have high hopes that they will have ceasefire sometime soon, and especially before Ramadan. And then they're saying, you know, every day when they text me, the first thing they say, I'm still alive. But we hear the bombing, you know, of getting closer and closer. I don't know by the time you get here if we're going to be alive, but we just want you to know that we're still alive. You know, don't forget our coffee. Don't forget our chocolate. Don't forget our medications.
Oh, they put in requests for things.
They want their medications, but they also want their fix of coffee and chocolate.
Okay. That's, well, I mean, it's these small things in that people enjoy.
Yeah, tiny, small things that would bring happiness to these children and people.
What are you hoping to accomplish next time you go? Later this month.
Actually bringing in more medications for chronic disease. We are focusing more to create another wound care team because the wounds were, like I said, there was a lot of, most everyone is injured and they have wounds. So we're creating another wound care team, and we're focusing again on wounds and surgeries. And hopefully we could treat some of the chronic diseases that they have there, that they, you know, that they're malnourished and they haven't had their medications in months.
What we're hearing is, I mean, what I've read and heard in some of the other interviews, that there is a huge number of orphan children, children that lost their parents, one or both parents, and they don't have people to either live with, or maybe they lost their entire family. Have you come across any of those type of children or?
Unfortunately, yes, I have.
Can you tell us about it?
I came across actually two boys. One is 5 years old and one is 15 years old. They lost both parents. They lost their siblings. And one of them was severely injured. He's had 40% of his body burnt. The other one had a double amputation. The five-year-old lost both of his legs. And then the 15-year-old, 40% of his body was burnt. So they were both severely injured. And their only survivor that's taking care of him right now is their grandmother, but she's an elderly woman who's unable to perform any of their needs, or she's unable to do anything for them. She's just there for the support, but the medical staff was helping out. Unfortunately, I have approached her to see if they would be up for adoption, and she completely refused.
Were you going to try to facilitate that, or are you thinking to take them?
I wanted to
adopt them yourself.
I wanted to, but the grandmother completely refused, and she was not agreeing to that. However, I was able to contact some organizations, and I was able to help them transport out of Gaza, and now they're in Egypt, and hopefully they will be either going to Qatar or coming to the U.S. for medical care.
We heard these kind of stories that people that are getting out of through Egypt, there's some, you know, it's like some insanely high price of $9,000, $10,000 per person. Is that true?
That is true.
And is that just to bribe their way out through with the Egyptians?
No, they actually pay. No, they pay this amount through a coordinator. There's people. There's an office in Gaza, or some people they coordinate these people to leave. Apparently, this is the fee to pay to the border to exit, you know, Gaza. This is the actual fees. It could vary anywhere between $5,000 to $7,000 right now per person, depending on what office or what person they go through.
Okay. It seems like a really high amount to pay to be able to get out. We have a few minutes left, and I just have a couple of other images that I wanted to, maybe you can describe for us what's happening here. This is an image where I see there's some sort of procedure that's being done on a person's leg.
This was actually a dressing change or a wound care that
what
I was
doing. What is that device on his leg?
This is called the X-Fix. It's an orthopedic device to stabilize his leg. These are explosive injuries. So basically he has a
injuries from explosives.
Yes, that is correct. And okay. It's a major injury, to be honest. So he has fractures, and then he had also a device to stabilize his leg.
For some reason, these images are rotated sideways. It seems like the conditions that were there were not really safe, even when you were outside. I don't know why.
Correct.
Having some... Okay. Well, we're basically out of time. I wanted to just give you a word. What is your message that you want to pass on to our listeners, and whether they're in the Tampa Bay area or across the country?
I'm hoping for a ceasefire, first of all. And then meanwhile, if any medical providers are listening, I'm hoping that they could join our medical mission trip so we could actually provide the maximum health care.
How would they find out about that mission?
They could go through PAMA. PAMA has a website. They could sign up. There's a direct email on there that they could, you know, as well email, or just go through PAMA. There's a lot of organizations out there, but the one that I have joined and went with is PAMA, because they seem to be going every 2 weeks right now.
So visit the website, Google Palestine American Medical Association, and
correct,
look for how you can join a delegation that's coming up. Maybe they can even be on your delegation. Stay safe on the next time that you go. And I hope that you'll be back on our show to report to us what happened. And maybe while you're there, we can actually talk to you. I don't know if there's a connection.
It's Megan, really poor connection.
Poor connection. Well, maybe we can do it through WhatsApp or something. Megan, what message do you have for our listeners and viewers?
The main message I have is to just get involved. Get to know who your local officials are. Get to know what's going on in your community. Register to vote. Find me if you can, whether it be on social media, anywhere, and please sign my letter. I'm pretty much tabling at all the protests right now, trying to get different people to sign on to the letter. We have over 350 signatures already. I will probably hand deliver it early next week to the Tampa offices, but I'm going to continue to get signatures until we get a permanent ceasefire. And also, if you haven't, call your representatives every day. Flood their emails, flood their voicemails. There's a Tampa WhatsApp group if you need to get added to it to get daily reminders and the telephone numbers. There's apps out there that can help you do it, but you need to make sure your voice is heard. So please get involved.
Thank you so much to both of you. I want to wish you both a happy Ramadan, or Ramadan Kareem. It's about to start, you know, in a few days. We'll be talking about that, where we're fasting from before sunrise to sunset daily. We'll be remembering and praying for the people in Gaza and Palestine for this violence to end. This has been True Talk on WMNF, WMNF Tampa. Have a great weekend, everyone. And thank you again for joining us. News is next.
Thank you.
دايما بما لا اشتهي واللي السنين ما قدمه غير اللي قلت نفسي فيه يلاقي قلبي فين دوا واللي اذاه اقرب مالي ده جرحي بيعلم وصعب تسكن الالام.
This is WMNF Tampa 88.5 on the left side of your dial, best little radio station on planet Earth. Stay tuned for the scoop. And then Mark Hart with It's the Music, and then Scott Elliott with Traffic Jam. So don't go anywhere.
سلام يا 300 وداع واللي له انا ما يسعوش فخانة الوداع تساوي.